Okay, thank you. It's a smaller audience, and I hope it'll be a shorter talk, but yeah, I do encourage questions. I wanted to take another run at yesterday's lecture and just to remind people what we covered. We're talking about the ADS-CFT correspondence. What I said is we could think of that as a dictionary between two different languages. On one side, the language is the language of gravity with a negative cosmological constant. On the other side, the language is the language of quantum field theory, but it's a special kind of quantum field theory. It's a quantum field theory that doesn't have any intrinsic scales, no masses, even at the quantum level. Those theories get a very special name. They're called conformal field theories, and that gives us the CFT of ADS-CFT. The ADS comes from looking at the simplest solution of Einstein gravity coupled to a particular, well, with a negative cosmological constant. I wrote out an equation and said, "Look, here's a constant." But that solution is called anti-de Sitter space or anti-de Sitter geometry or anti-de Sitter space-time, and then that gives us the ADS of ADS-CFT. The remarkable thing is, or one of many remarkable things, is we have two very different languages. But in particular, this theory lives in D space-time dimensions. So I'll remind you that I'm including time in my count of dimensions. Whereas the gravity theory lives in D plus one space-time dimensions. And that mismatch between the dimensions is the reason that we throw around the word holography. A set of lingo or buzzwords that I introduced yesterday was the idea. Maybe I'll get back to that. Sorry. I tried to give you a picture to think about this geometry. It's a very unusual place we discovered. Juggling would be a very interesting exercise in this space-time. But one of the things we discovered was that it's a very simple, a very symmetric space-time, and it has an interesting symmetry group. And this is the group of rotations and boosts in a space-time with D spatial dimensions and two time-like directions. Remember, this is a D plus one dimensional space. There's only one time. But we saw that these dimensions that I talked about here could be thought of as dimensions in some auxiliary space that were useful to describe or illustrate that geometry. But that picture was a picture of an infinite space. It was this hyperboloid that went off forever. And that's pretty inconvenient when you're drawing pictures on the blackboard or on your piece of paper. And so what we usually do are we draw these Penrose diagrams where we do a vial rescaling. We distort the distances while preserving various features, angles, the null cones. But it gives us then a finite picture that we can draw. And the ADS then looks like an infinite cylinder. Infinity is, okay, I made a mis-said that. It's actually the ADS is an infinite tube. Infinity, R equals infinity, is the cylinder at the edge of that tube, but the gravity is taking place in the middle of the space. And again, a characteristic of these pictures that we draw is that 45-degree lines are very special lines, and that those are the lines that massless particles would travel. And so there was some discussion of metrics, and so time-like or massive particles go up in the picture or anywhere inside that 45 degrees. Massless particles run at 45 degrees, and then there may be things or probes or questions we may ask about space-like directions, But generally, that's not a direction that the observers or particles would travel. Saying that it's actually the tube and the anti-de Sitter space is the inside, and that's where the gravity takes place, lets me introduce another piece of lingo. Often what's said is that the gravity takes place in the bulk, by which I mean the interior of that tube. In contrast, this theory with one less dimensions, the mnemonic is that we think of that as living on the boundary. So that would be the cylinder here. But I will see a sense in which that's correct. But you should really just think of it as a mnemonic, but it would be incomplete, or I'd be derelict if I didn't mention the words bulk and boundary, just because those are such familiar words or such common words in these discussions of holography. I tried to argue that an interesting way to think of it is that the reason that the gravity theory needs or what it does with the extra dimension is it organizes things by energy scales in the quantum field theory. And so large radii, things very close to the boundary, are short wavelengths, high energies, or UV degrees of freedom. Things deep in the interior are long wavelength excitations, or low energy excitations, or infrared excitations. Over here on the conformal field theory, one of the things I talked about was the fact, what made conformal field theory special was the fact that there were extra symmetries, and as well as things like translations and boosts, rotations. You also had extra symmetries like dilatations, and then something that I didn't really describe called special conformal transformations. But when you look at how those transformations interact, you again get this particular group, SOD, 2. And so you can start to see how symmetries on this side are matching symmetries on this side. What else was there? There was, I put in brackets here, classical. In general, we think this correspondence or this equivalence holds quite generally, but we're only really good at doing calculations over here in the gravity when we're talking about classical gravity, or at least I am. And by looking at a particular example, we had or acquired the intuition that what we're doing is we're pushing the conformal field theory to a particular corner of parameter space, or we're looking at a particular class of conformal field theories where there are a large number of degrees of freedom and strong coupling. And by focusing our attention there, on this side of the dictionary, we're able to work with just a classical theory of gravity on this side. One of the features of this theory was that it actually had dimensionful constants. There's the Newton's constant of Einstein gravity, or of gravity. And then there was the curvature scale of the geometry, which came from the cosmological constant. But what's relevant is not either scale alone, but that particular ratio. That gives us a dimensionless number. And in this particular case, with these powers, I get something that actually, well, I call the central charge, but that's a thing, that's a quantity that characterizes the number of degrees of freedom in the conformal field theory. So I feel like I've been talking, and I should pause to see if people have absorbed all that, or if there are questions about these very preliminary, these preliminary comments. Yeah?
So the thing that you said there, the ds squared always being a zero at 45 degrees, is that only true at the center, or?
No, that's a characteristic of these pictures. If I'm sitting over here, 45 degrees is null. If I'm, it doesn't matter where.
Then how does light curve if it's that's the case? I mean, it always follows ds equals zero, right? Ds squared equals zero.
Right. So I'm not sure what you mean by curve. It just follows a straight line in this picture.
Because, I mean, there was a picture yesterday where Master's particle that came.
Oh, well, what it did there is it made it all the way to infinity. And I'm imagining that there's some kind of boundary condition, or perhaps a mirror at infinity, that turned it around. Like if it was moving out here, I held up a mirror and it just turned around, it reflected off. So that yeah, well, it's going to mess up the picture, but that was a picture where the null ray hit something here.
Yeah, so that was just for infinite energies.
Right.
So what happened with finite?
Then I'm solving a wave equation, and
so it has to do with the boundary still, the fact that there's a boundary.
It's very, very useful. Anything that propagates, any physical signal that propagates will propagate inside that light cone, inside there's a whole cone here.
Yeah.
If I want to go into the details of what happens at when I talk about geodesics, implicitly what we're doing is we're taking, if you like, well, I'll say a bunch of words and you tell me if they're useful or not. I'm looking at a geometric optics approximation, and rather than looking at the full wave properties of the light, I'm just drawing lines and in some sense thinking that it's a wave packet with infinitely short wavelengths that are propagating there. And that's why Eva was insisting that I was talking about infinite energies. But it's still a very useful thing to think about the light cone. If you want to solve the equations for finite wavelengths, in fact, in ADS space, you can. But you're going to end up with hypergeometric functions and stuff that's not terribly illuminating. This is really characterizing the essential physics. Did you have a question?
It was just a detail, but I think I forgot exactly what L was, because I don't see how this fact or this quote gets dimensionless. Is it L to the
L is the, so L is a distance. It's what we call the curvature scale of this. It tells me how quickly the geometry is changing or on what length scales the geometry changes. And G is just Newton's constant, and in my favorite units where H bar and C are one, it has dimensions D. Or I'm also studying gravity in D plus one dimensions, and Newton's constant has then dimensions length to the D minus one. Other questions? Okay, we went a little bit further, and I said that, you know, in take two, where we had lost our inhibitions about knowing us, I forgot about this. I mean, in the example that we looked at, we had some special theory here, N equals 4, super Yang-Mills, and we had a type 2B string theory. But this was a gauge theory. It was a non-abelian, a very special theory, but it involved, it was like a Maxwell field on steroids. And so another way that people refer to this equivalence is they pick the word gauge for the gauge theory on this side and gravity for, well, the gravity theory on that side. So you'll also hear often people talk about gauge gravity duality. And perhaps that puts less emphasis on the idea that I need an ADS space. Yeah, I'll just leave it at that. That's another interesting set of words that people use. In take two, I said that one way that we characterize the conformal field theories is just to pick out or give a list of interesting operators in the theory. So this, you know, might be a scalar field to some power. It's characterized by a conformal weight. This tells me the response of that operator to dilatations. And then if I have a collection of operators, there's another set of numbers that tell me roughly about the three-point functions or how three of the operators interact together. And given this list and these symmetries, that's enough to actually tell me about all of the correlators in the vacuum. Now, how did that story get represented in the gravity? Well, I talked about this being a theory of gravity, but I'd like to couple other stuff to the gravity. And so the example I picked was a scalar field. That scalar field satisfies some wave equation. There's, you know, some Dalibertian here that has all these derivatives, but also knows about the ADS metric. There's a mass. And then in the dot, 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 that phi can interact with itself, with other fields, but that won't be very, well, that won't be relevant for what I'm going to say next, because I make the observation that this is a second order differential equation, and so there ought to be two independent solutions. And the way that we organize our boundary conditions or our solutions is we go to very large radius. And there the field in the examples I'm thinking of are all decaying away. And that's why these interactions weren't important. But the two independent solutions can be characterized by how rapidly they decay away. And in fact, that decay is related to the conformal dimension of the corresponding operator. And the coefficient, this is one of the coefficients that characterizes one of the solutions, is equivalent essentially to the expectation value of that operator, whereas this is a source that turns on the operator, say in the action or in the generating functional. And it has a slightly different decay here, but the sum of those two exponents is just the dimension of the space-time or the boundary in the gravity theory. And so that gave us a mapping, or it started to elucidate or expand the mapping between the two sides of the picture.
Rob?
Yeah?
Could you give a physical or intuitive motivation for this last 2 remarks? Or at least some hand-waving argument, why lambda and O appears.
I can say a bunch of words. You tell me if. I mean, one of the things I said was that moving here is like moving in energy or moving in scale. And so you can ask, how do these solutions, or in particular, how do these boundary values change as you scale the radius? And so if I just multiply, if r goes to lambda r, then you see that this boundary value is scaling in a very particular way as lambda to the delta. But that's precisely what I expect, because this is sort of the exponent that characterizes how that operator changes. And if I'm putting these together in an action, this is my source now. So this is a piece of an action. If I want this to be scale invariant, then this is actually scaling in a very precise way, and that's actually the exponent that I expect it to scale with. So while you're nodding your head, I guess you're happy with that.
So one more question.
Yep.
So on the left-hand side, under this discussion of the boundary conditions, how do I get multi-point correlation functions to appear in this language? So far it was just one-point functions.
Yeah, so what I'm, and in fact, what I said is I had a generating function, and typically what you do is you take derivatives of the generating function and then you set the lambdas to zero.
That's on the right-hand side, but on the left-hand side.
Right, but if I set the lambdas to zero, then I expect all of these to be zero as well. So let me say one more thing. You know, I said these were boundary conditions, and so you might think, oh, well, I'll just, set this to whatever I want, and I'll set the expectation value to whatever I want. And then we'll just solve my equations and I'll, the gravity will tell me what the solution is. But that's not the way you think that the physics should act or behave. In fact, typically what you do is I'm going to fix lambda. And that's fixing my source. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to solve my equations, and there's some dynamics here. And what I'm going to ask is that the solution, you know, I fixed one of the boundary conditions at infinity, and I'm going to ask that the solution is well behaved everywhere in the interior. In particular, things are getting big here as I move to small r, and I don't want to run into singularities. And so by demanding that I get a nice solution, that actually then tells me, or the gravity then tells me, what the expectation value is. And so these are characterizing the solutions, but the physics, or the appropriate physics, is really that, you know, I probe the system, or I deform the theory with the source, and then the gravitational dynamics, and demanding a nice, smooth, or a proper solution is going to tell me what that expectation value is. So that didn't answer your question. But I just wanted to make that point because it's here on my page. The other point that I wanted to make here before I get to the question is, you know, now we're going deep into the interior. The fields are getting big, and all this dot, dot, dot is going to matter. You know, the details of how it couples to itself, how it couples to other fields, are going to come into play in determining what that expectation value is. So there's lots of interesting physics of the CFT that's hidden there and in the gravitational dynamics. What did we have? So you wanted, I wrote some, is that, I'll pause there, is that everybody, is everybody's happy with that? The question, though, was more about this equation that I was writing the other day, where I had a generating function with the lambda i's here, and I said that they were equal, and on this side, I'm not going to write it out again. There's an object there. It has these. I perturb the theory by these. I can manipulate it. On the gravity side, we started by writing, you know, what the analogous object would be, which is I have something that I'm thinking of as a path integral weighted again by some action. It's got gravity fields in it, and I'm going to set some boundary condition here that, you know, I'll say phi, you know, at infinity phi is approximately lambda. I'm going to solve the equations, No, that's not what I'm going to do. So in principle, this is the object that I have to work with. But in practice, I said that, well, I'm not really doing quantum gravity. I'm just going to do classical gravity. And so what I'm going to say is that I'm going to evaluate this integral over lots of fields in a saddle point approximation. And so we're going to throw this away, and we're just going to evaluate this classically on a classical solution. So for every boundary condition, in principle, I can find a classical solution here. And so now I've got an object that's a functional of these boundary conditions. And I manipulate it in the same way that I would have manipulated this object. I can take variations with respect to the lambda, and I can think that what I'm building up are endpoint functions. Is that, yeah?
Yeah, next.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Because I get a second chance at this, I wanted to fill in a space in the board over here. And there was mention of the fact that, you know, with these conformal weights, what I'm doing is I'm characterizing representations of this conformal group. But you know, this conformal group also, it has lots of other, that was the response to the dilatations. It has lots of other transformations, and in particular we're interested in another set of commuting transformations being the rotations that are hidden in there. And so, you know, I used as my example, and implicitly here, a scalar, but you can also, well, it's usually written as S for the spin, you can think about the properties under rotations, or the angular momentum of the operator. And so a classic example, then, of an operator with spin is, well, what we call, or I don't know, maybe everybody calls the stress energy tensor. So that's going to be a symmetric tensor. And in fact, in a conformal field theory, it's also a traceless symmetric tensor. Maybe I'm supposed to write that. But it's characterized by having a conformal dimension that happens to be equal to D, the space-time dimension, but there are these two indices, and so we also say that it has spin 2. I don't know how familiar people are with the idea of stress energy tensor or energy momentum tensor, but, you know, this really is... If I look at the 0,0 or the time component, that really is the energy density in the system, and then I'm just packaging everything in a covariant way, or I'm packaging that in a covariant package. Another thing that I could say is that it's intimately related to the generators of these various symmetries that I talked about here. And another thing I could say is that it's intimately related to this object that I called CT that was counting the number of degrees of freedom. If I look at the two-point correlator off in the vacuum, I'll find that it's well, I'll put stuff there. It's essentially given by some expression that depends on lots of indices that I haven't written and the separation of these two insertions, but then the overall coefficient is precise, well, not precisely the way I've written it, but that's how this CT was defined, and that's the subscript that I put on the central charge. It's the T of the stress energy tensor. So again, are people happy with that? More or less happy? Okay. But then the question is, well, what happened over here on the gravity side? This is an operator that I'm going to find in, well, like I said, it's intimate related to, well, the energy density or the symmetry generators. And so that's an operator that I'm going to find in any CFT. And there's, well, an obvious object that has two indices that's going to be found in every theory of gravity. And in fact, it's the metric. So I can do the analogous thing here. I wrote down something. I mean, there's some set of equations, second order nonlinear differential equations, the Einstein equations, and I can play... Or I can go through the same analysis that I did there. And I would find that the metric takes a form where there are two independent coefficients. And they scale pretty much as expected. So here I said that delta was equal to D, and so here's the 1 over R to the D, and D minus delta is just 0, so this is a constant. there's some extra factor here with an R squared, and you can think that that might be related to the fact that this isn't a scalar anymore, but rather it has this extra quantum number, it has this spin 2. Now, I've been a little bit confusing in that this is an object that lives in the conformal field theory, and so these indices only know about d directions, whereas the full metric over here should know about d plus 1 directions. And so I have to put the caveat here that these are, I'll call them boundary directions, by which I mean not R. But it also points out that something that I fluffed over here was that I actually made a special coordinate choice. Certainly, you know, I picked a set of coordinates where I got this fall off, but Renato could just as easily have done the problem where he thought the radial coordinate was something he called U, and U was equal to R squared, and then he would have gotten different exponents here. So implicitly, when we're doing this kind of analysis, what I'm doing here is I'm saying that the RR component of the metric, you know, I can put an equal sign. I don't need the dr squared. But the RR component of the metric is precisely L squared over R squared. And I'm arranging my coordinate system so that there are no interactions or off-diagonal terms between these directions and the R direction. And if I make that choice, then this, well, then it makes sense to say, well, everything else then talks about the interesting dynamics. I said that this was the expectation value of the stress tensor, but this is the metric that the CFT sees, if you like. So you can think of the metric as being a source. If I change the geometry that the CFT is living in, the you'll see different responses in this expectation value of the stress tensor. But this is also a way, perhaps, to think that this is the boundary metric in a very precise sense, in that I'm going to infinity, and the leading term in the metric is given by this, well, up to this R squared factor, it's given by this. And that's defining the metric that the CFT sees.
Rob, can I think of what you wrote on the left-hand side as a special case of this other equation you wrote?
Sorry. It's a special case of that. What's distinguishing it is the fact that there are indices here now. This is a tensor, it's not a scalar. And as a result, I have to change the formulas a little bit. And so that too is related to the spin.
Okay. And the fact that there's some special thing about delta equal
to E,
right?
But the delta over here is precisely equal to D, and so I'm getting a constant term,
right,
and a term that drops off like 1 over R to the D. Sorry? Right, and I said that you could think that that was related to the fact that this is no longer a scalar. These were objects without any indices. This is an object with two indices. And in this representation language, that's the fact that it's S equals 2. Or it has non-trivial transformation properties when I do rotations or boosts.
So the fact that the boundary at the moment is accepted continuous?
Yeah.
What does it mean then if you not to be?
No, if I'm studying... if I'm studying just empty ADS space, if I look at this picture, I would say that the geometry is, you know, a line. So is a line for time. And then I could only draw two spatial directions. And so the boundary here was a circle, but if I had many, many more, I would end up with a sphere in an appropriate number of dimensions, but I get a D minus two sphere. So if I have a three-dimensional bulk, which is what I'm drawing, I get a line cross a circle. That's just R cross S1. If I was doing a four-dimensional bulk, this circle would be a regular sphere, a two-sphere. I'd have an S2, and we can go on up in dimensions. And so there is a coordinate system here where I can play this game, and what I see at infinity is a geometry that looks like R cross this sphere. On the other hand, I'm doing a conformal field theory, and so the conformal field theory really doesn't care about the details of the geometry per se. It only cares about the geometry up to a vial rescaling. And so I can play the same game. I can find other coordinate systems where what I'm effectively doing is I'm taking a piece of this full geometry, but I'm producing something that looks very different. I can find something that looks like flat space, say. I can look where what I would get here would be this A to AB. But then the coordinate system that I'd be talking about here would actually only be talking about a chunk of the ADS, or a piece of the ADS space. It wouldn't be talking about this full infinite tube or the cylinder. Yeah?
You say you could play this game for any Ds. Does that mean that you can, for D or for ADS 2, you can get quantum mechanics on the boundary?
Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Yes and no. I mean, there are subtleties. It really doesn't work the way that I'm talking about here. But how about I leave it like that? There are subtleties, and so I guess maybe I should have said no. Actually, people are talking about near ADS2 and holography in that situation. And people originally sat down and they said, oh, well, it works for D equals 2. I'm talking about conformal quantum mechanics. But there are subtleties with the gravity theory and understanding what's going on in the boundary. But it's been revived sort of by these discussions at SYK recently. Other questions? Oh, another question.
I'm still a bit confused about what you mean when you relate stuff. So you explained now that okay. If I take an object there with the ABs, then these ABs really match, for example, the ABs there. If I get rid of this
what were the ABs?
So the AB indices that are in the tensor. So you explained how these match to those, and you said,
right.
Just get rid of the extra dimension by not looking at R. But now I also want to relate the X that you wrote there, the position to the X. I mean, you wrote X's on both sides, but they also don't match in dimension. So.
Oh, they do. Oh, they don't? This was an X, C, so there are D of these. Over here, yeah?
Okay.
Over here I said that I had the radius R, and then the directions labeled by A and B. So A and B
are the
boundary direction. So they'll only run over, let's say, 0 for time, 1, you know, and the spatial directions. So there are d of these directions.
So for example, the GA zero has an x.
It can depend on XA. What I've isolated here is the dependence on the radius. It was the same thing here with the source. I isolated the dependence on the radius, and just because it gets suppressed in the wave operator, these sources can depend on the spatial or the boundary directions. And the same thing here, right?
This is really important that you make this separate. I mean, you take this coordinate R out.
Yeah, and it's important that I choose my coordinates in this particular way. And that, you know, what you'll find is that you're not allowed to choose U equals R squared. That would mess up this stuff.
Okay.
So, but it looks like I can still transform the X's in between them without ruining the condition, right? But somehow this should match with those coordinates?
No, absolutely. Over here, well, okay, if we're in flat space, you know, I can do translations, I can do rotations, I can do boosts. Those were all allowed transformations. I can also do the dilatations and the...
But then I can do more. I don't have to do something that respects the
right
image. I can just do whatever transformation I want, right?
And so, yeah, okay. You can, yes. You can choose whatever coordinates you want. Coordinates are your friend. Choose the best one.
How do you guarantee that those two are the same? Like, those X's there and the X's in the. I mean, they have to match for them to be exactly the same in both theories, right? I mean, I just.
I guess if I do a coordinate transformation over there, the background metric. Well, I guess it's a postulate that these X's are the same as those X's. But if I do a coordinate transformation here, the metric is an object. It has an, you know, each component depends on X. It has indices that point in different directions. There's a set of rules on how I transform from my original metric to my new metric. In the same way, this is an object that transforms in a very particular way. If I go over here and I just postulate, you know, these things, those X's are the same as those X's. If I do the standard coordinate transformations that I want to do because I'm doing gravity on this side, these objects are transforming in precisely the same way that I expected them to transform over there. Okay?
You're talking about different aspects of this duality, for example, how central charge shows up there. And,
yeah.
So I was wondering if I can understand some of these examples of the duality as a consequence of equivalence between two irreducible representation of S over D2.
Consequence of two?
Equivalence of two irreducible representation of S over D2.
A lot of it, you probably could. On the other hand, my claim is that, you know, the gravity dynamics and the details here are doing, you know, physics is doing something interesting here. That you know, just the group theory isn't going to tell me in my CFT when I turn on the source what is the expectation value that I expect to get. I really need to know the physics to get that to work. And so there's a lot of what I'm doing here, I guess, is, yeah, it's group theory, or are relying on group theory. But the physics is really, you know, playing a role in things like this. And implicitly, if I was doing, or could carry out the same quantum field theory calculation over there.
So there's more than just equivalence of two irreducible representations.
Yes. I would claim there is. Wow, okay. Okay, good. Now I'm going to erase all that. I mentioned this last day, but the idea or something that people were worried about was you know, I gave you ADF, but that's just one geometry. You know, where's the gravity? Well, the gravity determined the ADF. This was a, you know, fixing the scale was part of it. But I can do other things. And I talked about, well, you know, there are other solutions with gravitons propagating around in my ADF. But at the end of the day, all we really care about are that the geometry asymptotically goes to ADS. I mean, one of the things that we talked about was that we were adding these sources. We were adding new operators. So for example, I can take my conformal field theory and I can perturb it by a relevant operator. That then sends it down some renormalization group flow and generates, well, something else. It may end at another fixed point. It may crash into, I don't know, oblivion. But I set up the technology here where we could study that as well. And so we can do more than just study the CFT and the CFT vacuum, which is the geometry, you know, given by correlators and manipulations involving just the ADS space. We can generalize the discussion to asymptotically ADS spacetimes. And saying that I'm asymptotic, just to be clear, what I mean when I'm going to very large radius, the spacetime should relax back to this sort of ADS form here. So those are saying that at high energies, I get back to the CFT, but at low energies, we can have I'm for want of better or more eloquent words, we can just have more interest in physics. And so I described or the example I gave was I can talk about renormalization group flows. There might be various phenomena that Suber can tell us about. You know, we can study various phase transitions. But the canonical example that I wanted to say a few more words about was thinking about a thermal bath or a thermal state or a thermal plasma. It's just an example that plays a central role in many, many discussions. So, okay, so this is going to be the target. But I want to describe a certain geometry. I don't know if I mentioned this already, but you want to think about an asymptotically ADS or an ADS black hole. And another code word that I'm going to give you is I'm going to look at an eternal black hole. So what I'm doing is I'm writing down the simplest solution or the simplest black hole solution that we have in solving the ADS geometry. I'm not thinking about a system where I've got some matter and it collapses to form a black hole, which is typically what happens. We can also talk about this, but we're just taking a simple solution and then we're seeing what that full geometry looks like. What I'm going to do is I'm going to draw one of these Penrose diagrams. And so the diagram that I draw looks like this. I just realized it was a marvelous opportunity to use the colored chalk, but I didn't. So here I have a picture of a space-time, or a Penrose diagram of a space-time. There are these wavy lines here, and those are singularities. Those are places where the geometry, or where the curvature, the curvature becomes arbitrarily large or diverges, or the geometry starts varying extremely rapidly, and actually Einstein's equations are breaking down, and we don't really understand what happens at those points. I drew a straight line running up and down here, and that's like the straight line at the boundary of our cylinder, and so this is actually r equals infinity. And I'm only drawing, again, time runs up. And so I'm only drawing the radial direction and the time direction, but when I think of a point here, what I've suppressed is the fact that there's an extra sphere. So when I sit at a point, there are a bunch of extra transverse dimensions that I can move in. And so I could choose that, say, to be a d minus 1 sphere at each point. And again, that counts up then to d plus 1 dimensions. There's d minus 1 spatial dimensions here that run around the sphere. There's time, and then there's the radius. And so I have d plus 1 dimensions. What else do I have on the picture? I have the big X that runs through the picture. And so those are just denoting special places in the space-time. And they're known as the horizon. Those are the boundary, well, up here it's the boundary of no return. And I'll explain in a moment. So I'll call that the future horizon because it's higher in the picture. That's the past horizon because it's lower in the picture. It's at an earlier time. But a feature of this geometry is, I said that null cones always run at 45 degrees. And any signal that I want to send propagates within that opening angle. And so if I'm sitting at a point inside this part of the V, past the future horizon, then anything I do, or any signal I have, any observer I have, will run into the singularity. If I'm an observer in my rocket ship out here, if I'm propagating along, I can go off to infinity, but if I have the unfortunate experience of crossing that line, then all hope is lost. I mean, once I'm here, there's nothing I can do to get back outside the black or beyond this surface. No matter what I do, my future is to run into that singularity, no matter what I do with my rocket engines. And that's why we get the name then black hole, because that's why this is called the event horizon. This is the surface of no return. Now, in this eternal black hole, there's this funny symmetry that there's sort of an equivalent region down here. This is often called the white hole region, because rather than absorbing things, this one expunges things. If I'm sitting here, there's nothing I can do to remain inside. Eventually, I will either cross out to that side or to that side, with very, very tiny probability, for the lawyers in the audience. There's one possibility where I could cross just at the X here and I wouldn't get to either side here. But for the white hole region, things are running away from the singularity. In the black hole region, or in the beyond the future horizon, we're always running towards the singularity. One thing that I haven't talked about is there's another straight line that caps off the diagram on this side. And in fact, there's a symmetry in the picture between the left and the right. And that's because the geometry here is the same as the geometry here. And so this is actually another asymptotically ADS boundary. So there, one of the key features for the eternal black hole is that there are two asymptotically ADS, or there are two ADS boundaries, or asymptotically ADS regions. Another set of words that you may have heard then is the idea of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. And that's simply the idea, if I'm not an observer, if I'm just probing or thinking about the geometry, if I start on this side, you know, I'm at R equals infinity, and so the spheres that I was talking about are very, very large. I move inward to smaller radius, the spheres get smaller and smaller and smaller, but then they reach a minimum size at this point. And if I continue out on this side, the spheres start to get larger and larger and larger until they're infinitely big again when I reach this line on that side. And so there's a connection then in the geometry between the two sides, this asymptotic boundary and that asymptotic boundary.
What is the minimum size of the sphere?
I'm not sure whether I want to give you a yellow card or not.
But I'm not an expert on this.
Well, it depends on my choice of black hole, but it's and it depends on the dimension of the space-time. But if I say it's proportional to the entropy, does that make you happy, or you're not happy with that? It's proportional to the, well, we haven't gotten there yet. it's given by the mass of the black hole.
I don't want to know whether it's zero or not. No.
That was the point. I get down to some finite radius, okay, or a finite size sphere here, and then I wander out here and they get bigger again. So nothing singular happened. This is perfectly smooth geometry.
Rob, I may be confused about a very basic point about the picture. Isn't this thing still in a cylinder, right?
No, if I go out here, that line is actually a cylinder. Oh, here's time, uh-huh, and every point on that is the sphere.
Oh, I see.
And so what we've done is we've managed to glue two cylinders together because there's another cylinder over here.
Ah, okay. Okay, so that's why you can go from one to the other.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But then, just very briefly, what's the translation? Well, I had promised that I was going to talk about a thermal bath. And so on the gravity side, we have black hole. On the CFT side, we have thermal bath. And so that's an example then where the language, the words sound very, very different. If I have a thermal bath, I might ask, what's the temperature? Then we have to go a little bit beyond classical gravity, and we have to remember that about 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago now, 45 years ago, what Stephen Hawking showed us is that, you know, I describe the black hole as something that things fall in and they can never escape. But what Stephen Hawking showed is that if I take into account quantum fluctuations of the fields in that geometry, then they slowly leak out or tunnel out and carry off energy to infinity. And in fact, what you get out at infinity looks like a thermal spectrum. And so there's a natural temperature that I can ascribe to the black hole if I go beyond purely classical gravity and I go to a semi-classical interpretation, or I take into account small fluctuations. So on this side, I'll write what I have, what I'll call the Hawking temperature. And I'll just say that quantum fluctuations allow the black hole to leak, if you like. So we have a temperature that we can ascribe to the black hole, and that then becomes the temperature of the thermal bath in the CFT. Another question we might ask is, you know, what is the entropy or the entropy density in the thermal gas or in the thermal plasma? But again, a part of this story is that not only is there a temperature, but there is an entropy that I ascribe to the black hole. And so it's actually the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is given by a famous formula. F. Bekenstein-Hawking is given by the area of the horizon divided by 4G. And so what that area of the horizon means is I take a cross-section of the horizon. I actually mean the future horizon. And so I can ask, what's the area of that sphere right here in the middle? Or there's a certain symmetry that says that the area of that sphere here is exactly the same, or that sphere here, or that sphere here, that sphere here. Those all the spheres at all of those points have exactly the same symmetry. And if I evaluate that area, I find, and I divide by Newton's constant, I have an entropy that I ascribe to the black hole. And that becomes then the entropy of my thermal bath on the other side.
Is there an object like this on the past horizon as well, or there's nothing like that? Something has entropy.
I mean, you can look at cross sections there as well. We tend not to, because usually what we're thinking about is some kind of matter that fell in, collapsed to form a black hole, and the horizon extends, you know, or we form the horizon and extends off to infinity, and so that horizon starts with zero size and it grows to whatever its maximum is, and so usually we talk about. Or I would talk about the future horizon, not the past. Marty?
Isn't the concept of the Einstein-Rosen bridge already transcend classical mechanics?
How so?
Well, I thought it was kind of a tunneling process to get.
I just solved some... I might use the words tunneling when I start talking about the Hawking temperature, but when I'm talking about the Einstein-Rosen bridge, as in the way I've presented it, I just solved some classical, you know, GR equation. I cranked out a metric, and then I tried to understand what geometry was that was describing, and it was this one here. So I don't see any H-bars or any tunneling.
It's all like an instant.
I don't think so. There's. I'll say no, for now, because I actually have to leave at noon because I have a plane to catch. So.
Better. In the beginning, you mentioned a specific example of an equatorial sphere Young-Mills on the boundary.
Yeah.
So is there a state of that theory that are then matches that theory?
Yes. So, 10 seconds. One of the things I commented on was there are two asymptotic boundaries. If we apply the technology that we had before, that means we've got twice as many things, that, you know, twice as many sources as we expected that we can probe here. Or alternatively, what you can think is, I have the right sets of degrees of freedom to describe two copies of the CFT, not just one. And so the fact that there are two boundaries here, I should interpret as the fact that, in fact, what I'm describing here is something slightly more complicated than I set out to describe. I'm describing something that involves two copies of the CFT.
Doesn't that conflict with what you said about...
No, it doesn't.
Maps?
It does, but what I said is I'm not describing a collapse here. This is the eternal black hole. So let me just describe the eternal black hole, and if you want to come back to collapse, you should ask me before, or late, not before, later. We have two ADS boundaries. Two ADS boundaries, and implicitly that means that I've got two copies of the CFT in play here in this geometry. And the way that we can understand that is that what this is describing is the so-called thermofield double. State, by which I mean that I should think that what I have is a geometric description there of a state where I'm correlating the two states in the two copies of the CFT. So there's a left copy, a right copy, and I'm correlating the energy states with this particular factor. And that defines then an entangled state between the two copies of the CFT. And so I can probe that state by, you know, putting, I can put some source here, some source here. I can put multiple sources here, multiple sources here.
Okay,
I'll say it now. I mean, here what I ascribe to that geometry, that space-time, is a particular state. Certainly I can evolve a state in time, and so that's an overstatement. But what I want to what my claim is that this surface here that I call the Einstein-Rosen bridge is precisely then, or the fields on that surface are the holographic dual of this particular state here. I can then take that state and evolve it in time or play games with it, and that would fill out then, or we expect that that's filling out the rest of this full space-time geometry.
Can I ask what are the words behind this? I know you're running out of time. It says, let us invite ourselves to look at this state, and you don't worry about how it gets entangled or... I mean, how do I know this is the right state?
How did they get entangled? That's an excellent question. I have a whole other talk about that, but you're not going to get that today. Sorry. Can I just say one thing? That, you know, one of the things I could have done is I set out to just study the physics of the CFT in a thermal bath, and so I could just study. You know, I can probe it over here. And then all I'm seeing is half of this picture. And so if I only probe say CFT right, then effectively I'm doing physics in the, well, the what I expected, the thermal density matrix. Like that. And there's, you know, there are geometric constructions that I don't want to go into that really lend more support to this and to a construction that tells me what I'm really talking about here. But they involve going to the Euclidean or Wick rotating, thinking about a Euclidean geometry and going into the details of what's going on at the horizon and whatnot. And I hope to try and do that. And so I'm just going to set that aside and turn and ask for questions. And Cedric has a question.
Sorry, just to finish the question. But in the beginning, you say that dual of Hellinger force by Young-Mills is specifically string theory on Earth.
Oh, can I just ask? So one thing I can do to lend support to this interpretation is I can think about probing both sides here and seeing what those correlators look like, and you can see that they behave in a way that you would have expected in this thermal field double. Sorry, Cedric.
So in the beginning you were saying that the dual of n equal force by Young-Mills is specifically string theory on a fixed EDF background with no backup. So how is the backup process?
originally when we set out we started in the vacuum or with just empty ADF, and we built up our confidence by studying that and understanding how the duality works there. But then I made a transition and I said, you know, now that I have confidence, I can start to think about these other kinds of geometries that are only asymptotically ADFs. And so I was presenting to you just, here's another, quote-unquote, simple solution of the Einstein equations. And then I'm asking, how do I interpret that in a consistent way within this holographic?
What specifically, one specific ADS safety?
Right.
And you said n equal for specific n equal for super Young-Mills.
So I'm not sure what you want me to do. If I put a subscript n equals 4 super Young-Mills, would you be happy? Or I'm not sure what you're looking for.
Well, you said the dual of n equal for super Young-Mills theory, so when you say theory, I guess you include all the states and everything.
Yeah.
Was a string theory on ADS background.
Okay.
At zero temperature.
Well, originally we were working in the vacuum, right, and at zero temperature,
okay, so
and that was the ADF space. And we noted that the symmetries of the vacuum in the CFT match the symmetries of the vacuum in the geometry.
The ADF space is only dual to vacuum of n equal force space.
Right. And then what we did is we built up small excitations by putting these probes in there and looking at
it. You're matching state to state, not theories to theories.
State to state.
You're matching the vacuum of one theory to. Okay.
So if all I want to talk about is ADS and nothing else, I would say that's the vacuum, yeah. But that's not a very interesting thing to do. I understand. But so that's just one notch or one entry, and then on the vacuum we can start to build more exciting states by throwing in probes. And that's what I was trying to describe before. And then we took a leap and we started talking about, okay, well, let's think about things that go beyond just small excitations of ADS. This is, if you like, a big excitation, or this is actually something new, but it leaps out at us because this is a familiar solution on the GR, on the gravity side. This was a familiar solution, and I was trying to tell you that there's a consistent interpretation of that within this dictionary or within this holographic
study. And you don't need some strange shift that we don't know. I just can use n equals 4 square symmetry, and that would
work. You could, yeah, you can do this in n equals 4. You know, all I would do is I would say this is five-dimensional, you know, ADS black hole, and I'd say cross S5, and we're golden. It's still a solution in that theory.
Is that horizon like a light cone? Does it behave like a light cone?
Yeah, those lines are supposed to be running at 45 degrees.
So if you're inside on the top part,
yeah,
and you tunnel out, I see no way you could connect the line and have it be less than 45 degrees. So it's sort of, is it superluminal?
You mean the tunneling?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, but that's why it's quantum, right? There's some kind of quantum process. It's not a classical process. Classically, this was a black hole. Anything that falls into the black hole stays in the black hole and gets...
How do you draw a tunneling process in the diagram?
How do I draw?
Is there a convention? Is it just instantaneous? Like it just disappears and pops out on the other side of the 45 degree line? What happens?
I will refrain. I think Xi Dong is going to talk about that this afternoon. No. I'm going to refrain from trying to answer that question. I don't really think. Do I know any people?
No, that's like asking when does tunneling occur?
Yeah. No, but you could try and do it in a first quantum. Let's set that aside. I'm going to run away shortly, but if you want to ask me next week, we can try and work something out and maybe come up with some pictures.
Yeah, Rob, I still need some words to put things into perspective for me to understand. So let's go back. Okay, people cannot do quantum gravity, so they go to string theory, which I think of as a huge, complicated integral. Mm. And you guys discovered that this huge integral, under some restrictions or certain sectors, can be mapped into another integral. Mm-hmm. So the whole point was to integrate over the gravitational field, which you couldn't do, but this integral can allow you to do that. But then in this story, at some point, you then went to classical, as you
right.
did on the board. I'm not going to integrate over the gravitational field and cross everything out. The original motivation was to do this integral.
Yeah.
So somehow this integral that you started out with, which you cannot do, but you make more complicated. Then eventually you saw the integral you started out with.
Yeah.
And then you discover something amazing.
Yeah.
Can you put some words behind this so I could understand? This is, after all, you back to classical.
You know what? I'm going to talk about something else.
Okay.
And then at noon, you should stop me and say, but what about my question? And then I'll ramble on for 10 minutes,
okay.
And then I'll run out of the room and go to the airport.
Okay.
Because I did want to help Xi Dong set up one thing. Let's see if we can do that in 10 minutes. So one of the cool things that we're seeing here is there's an entropy, and I ascribe that to the entropy of the thermal bath. But in fact, in this language here, we can think of the entropy as being an entanglement entropy, namely the entanglement between the degrees of freedom in our left copy and the degrees of freedom in our right copy. And so there's this idea then that this becomes the entanglement entropy between the two copies of the thermofield double. And in fact, then what that entanglement, by taking, I could have taken these two copies and just put them each in their own vacuum, and that would have been their own ADS spaces, and they wouldn't have talked to each other. Geometrically, there would have been no connection. But by introducing the correlations in a very specific way of the thermofield double, and by introducing that entanglement between the two, what we've done is we've built this geometric connection between the two geometries, or this asymptotically ADS region and this asymptotically ADS region. And so there's some kind of interesting idea then that entanglement entropy is responsible for some new interesting geometric connections. And so that's a great way to make a segue to something called holographic entanglement entropy. And so this is, when you see a phrase like this, holographic entanglement entropy, that's somebody who's taking the idea from some other field, namely in this case entanglement entropy, and they're mashing it together with ADS-CFT and saying, well, what does that topic have to tell me about ADS-CFT? And so in this case, though, I'm talking about entanglement entropy in a CFT or entanglement entropy in a quantum field theory, and so I want to step back for a moment just to describe the standard or the typical entanglement entropy question, just to make sure that we're on the same page. I hope that everybody's familiar with entanglement entropy. So in our neighborhood, what we do is we talk about entanglement entropy in a quantum field theory. And so this really is the standard entanglement entropy. And so the first thing we want to do is we want to take our quantum system and we want to divide it into two parts. But actually, the first thing we do is we pick a constant time slice. So that's this funny parallelogram. We're implicitly saying that the field configurations on this time slice are characterizing the space of states that live there. Then we want to divide it into two. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce some boundary, or something that's often called now the entangling surface. And the reason it's the entangling surface rather than the boundary is boundary's been taken. Boundary means the boundary of ADS space. And so to avoid confusion, I'll call that the entangling surface. But that's really dividing the system. Its role is to divide it into an inside and an outside. What I'm going to do is I'm going to integrate out the degrees of freedom on the outside. That leaves me with a density matrix describing the degrees of freedom, a reduced density matrix describing the degrees of freedom on the inside. And then I just use von Neumann's formula, trace rho log rho, throw in a minus sign. And so that's what we're calling the entanglement entropy in this particular, or that's the question that we're interested in. Now, unfortunately, I can tell you what the answer is without doing any calculations. The answer here is infinity. And the problem is that I'm working in a quantum field theory where there are correlations down to arbitrarily small distance scales. And so everything is dominated by those short distance correlators in the vicinity of the entangling surface. So there are correlations down to arbitrarily short distances as I approach, that are coming into play as I approach there. And so that's a problem.
Can you introduce a lattice?
I can, yes. Sorry. We say that it's UV divergent and it's dominated, or what I'm meaning there is that it's dominated by short range correlation. And so, as Tony was saying, to make sense of the calculation, we have to regulate our quantum field theory. We can do that in many different ways. And what I'm going to say, though, is that there's a short distance cutoff, delta, and in this context, it might just mean that I'm just going to ignore any correlations over distance scales shorter than that distance delta. And if I do that, then if there's some macroscopic scale that characterizes the size of that region, what I'll find is that I now, because I've regulated, I get a finite answer, and that answer takes the form that depends on the ratio of the size of the system to the cutoff here. Like that. And so I get a sensible finite answer, and the powers of those ratio, here it's d minus 2, here it's d minus 4, where as usual d is the space-time dimension. And if I assign my students the problem of not just doing this calculation for one particular geometry or one particular entangling surface, for lots and lots, what we find is that these numerators actually have a nice geometric interpretation. And in fact, the first one is just the volume or the area of that particular surface. The second one involves an integral over that surface of some geometric quantities. -4... And it's really this, well, this is maybe something that we were familiar with. This is, on HEPTH, we know as the area law, and it really goes back, well, I think the first person who noted this was Raphael Sorkin. So I'll just pause there. I've used up my 10 minutes, but I'm going to say one more thing. So that's just the idea of entanglement entropy in quantum field theory as opposed to, say, a spin system. Are we relatively happy with all of those statements?
Yeah, it's 12 o'clock, so how long about my
Yeah, I know. I'm going to say.
But I think we should let the participants in the program have their preferences. You have 20 years worth of chance to learn this one.
I just want to set. Okay, you guys can argue and I'll. Oh, rats. I messed up my picture. Okay, we're happy with that? Okay, then we're going to do ADS-CFT, and we're going to in ADS-CFT, we have a quantum field theory, namely, it's the boundary quantum field theory, the CFT. And so, in some sense, we can think that this is a relevant picture, but this is a picture that lives off at the boundary of the ADS. So I'll write this funny symbol, boundary of ADS. And in my cartoon then now, in this empty, newly emptied space underneath that picture, this is the bulk of ADS, R equals infinity bulk. And then the question is, you know, how can I use or interpret this question in the gravitational language? Or really, how can I take advantage of the gravity language to do this calculation in the boundary conformal field theory? And so this then becomes the Ru Takayanagi prescription. What they suggested is that I should think about all of the surfaces that hang down into the bulk, but then connect up, or they reach the boundary just along this particular entangling surface. And then what I should do, well, I'll just call RT. What I should do is I should evaluate for all such surfaces as this, and I'll just remind you, this was a time slice, so this is a d minus one dimensional surface. You should think that it's a Euclidean surface. This we fixed time in this picture. This was t equals zero, and I'll call those surfaces v. And so I'm supposed to evaluate the area or the volume of those surfaces. And then I'm supposed to divide by 4g. That's now a familiar formula, or it's a formula that Bekenstein and Hawking introduced us to when we were talking about black holes. Here I'm not talking about black holes, but I'm using that same formula. And then what I'm supposed to do, though, is there are lots and lots of surfaces that connect up in that way, and so what I'm supposed to do is I'm supposed to find the minimum value of this quantity, and these surfaces, I characterize them as ending, or their boundary is the entangling surface out at infinity, and if I find that minimum, that then becomes the desired entanglement entropy of this reduced density matrix in the conformal field theory. And so what we've managed to do is we've managed to translate this calculation, or what they proposed is that I can translate that calculation in the boundary CFT to this calculation in the gravitational language. There are lots of technical details, and I'll leave Veronica to tell you about that after I'm headed to the airport. About this becoming this this actually I should think of as a homology, that V should be homologous to the region A, and this minimum I should think of as being an extremum, where I'm looking for a saddle point of the area, not necessarily the minimum of that. But those are all technical details. But I did want to point out one thing, which is that I know what the answer is before I do the calculation. The answer is infinity. And why is that? Because I'm trying to integrate the area all the way to r equals infinity, so of course it diverges. And so you might think that's a bug in the program, but it's not. It matches what I told you here. And in fact, it matches very, very well. What was relevant here, what was causing that problem, was the very high energy or short wavelength degrees of freedom. In our gravitational language, those are degrees of freedom that I told you I associate with degrees of freedom in the gravity theory that are very, very close to r equals infinity. So this I can really think of as the same UV divergence that we had over there. And it has a simple solution, which is that what we do is we don't integrate to infinity. We cut off our integral at some maximum radius. And that maximum radius is inversely proportional to this short distance cutoff here. So the bigger I get in R, the smaller my short distance cutoff is. These are both distances, and so there's a mismatch here. But I have this useful conversion constant, or this dimensional scale in ADS. And so the right formula is that R max is equal to L squared over delta. And if I do, if I cut off my integrals in this particular way, in fact, I get a finite answer. And it's not hard to show that what comes out is something that looks at the leading order, the first contribution. Ah. is an expression like this. Namely, there's some numerical factor that may depend on D and whatnot. There's this ratio of the ADS scale to the Newton's constant. I needed to get a Newton's constant. But that's just, again, talking about what are the number of degrees of freedom, or characterizing the number of degrees of freedom in our boundary theory. But then I get precisely this area law. This is the area of the entangling surface measured in that metric G naught. And this is appropriate, just the right power of the short distance cutoff. And of course, that's only the leading contribution. There are lots of other contributions. But again, we're making a match to this formula here. And well, I'm sure you'll hear more about it this afternoon, except the G seems to have run away. But you know, when this was originally proposed in 2006, it came out of the blue. Nobody was thinking about entanglement entropy none of the holographers were thinking about entanglement entropy. And so it was really something that actually, what we did is we basically all ignored it. But it wasn't proven until, that's Lukowitz Maldacena in 2013. But there are all sorts of, in the meantime, what people did is they proposed all sorts of consistency tests. So for example, I didn't mention it, but in a two-dimensional CFT, there's a lot more control. And so there are precise formulas for what I should get for the entanglement entropy in a two-dimensional CFT. Those have to be true of any CFT, and so they better be true of holographic CFTs. And if you use this calculation that I've written on the board there, you get precisely the answer that people like Calabresi and Cardi suggested one needed to get in the two-dimensional CFTs. And there's a whole bunch, but I'm not going to have time to talk about them. But this, I think, may set the stage for something that you'll hear about this afternoon in the discussion that Ji Dong is running. And so I should, that may have been very quick, but I'll just ask if there are any questions. People got dazed, okay.
Thank you.